So tonight I want to talk about chapters, as I said, 8 and 9. But before that, there's one verse in chapter 7 that is actually very weird. And Sue, she covered chapter 7 really well and said a lot of stuff, but she didn't bring up this verse at all. And so since she didn't bring it up, I wanted to bring it up because it struck me as very unusual. I don't think there's another verse in the whole Dhammapada that's has the qualities of this one. And it's verse 97. That's right at the end of chapter 7. And this is Gill's, I'm going to use tonight mostly Gill's version. The person who has gone beyond faith knows the unmade, with a capital U, has severed the link, destroyed the potential, meaning the potential for rebirth, and eliminated clinging, is the ultimate person. The person who has gone beyond faith knows the unmade, has severed the link, destroyed the potential, and eliminated clinging is the ultimate person. So that's not so weird, but what's weird about it is, if you look at the footnote, and both, I was looking at this one and Tanisaro's translation, both of them note this, and here's the footnote. Unmade, akata, is a synonym for nirvana. Severed the link means the causal link between one life and another, between death and rebirth, but it refers to the whole links of causality that create false continuity. But then, here's this. This verse, and I'm reading on the notes on page 124 of Gill's text, this verse is filled with puns and is sometimes taken as a riddle. In addition to having literal value as translated here, it may also have been composed for shock value, as it could alternately be translated like this. So the same words could be translated like this. The person who is without faith and gratitude, who breaks into people's homes, who has destroyed opportunities, and who has vomited, is an audacious person. So it's full of puns, you know, you can imagine. I mean, we can't reproduce the puns in our language, but isn't that weird that there's a verse in the Dhamma, a text which is so pure and pristine and unironic, would suddenly have a verse like that, which is full of puns and could be read in two different ways. So you have to ask, like, what is that doing in there? Why would there be a verse like that? It's not a coincidence, I don't think. You know, it's a literary, it's done on purpose. And so I have a couple of thoughts on, I don't really know why it's there, but a couple of thoughts that I have. First of all, I've always thought that the Dharma is very, very weird in that it is both at the simultaneously, it is a simple and practical way to lead an ethical and happy life. You know, anybody who would want to, you know, find more happiness and find a way of life that sort of makes sense could be inspired by the Dharma to find that life. And at the same time, the Dharma is actually a radical break and rejection of ordinary life and rational life. It's both those things. It's on the one hand, how to live an ordinary life. On the other hand, cutting off ties, cutting off attachments, cutting off desires. So the Dharma proposes to be a way to find joy and satisfaction in life that is exactly the opposite of any normal life. Abandon normal life. Follow the path of the Dharma, which is the opposite of normal life. So it's both those things at the same time, and the Buddha somehow or other managed to teach a path that he could offer to ordinary people in the world who were not monastics and so on, and at the same time a radical path for people who abandoned everything else in their lives but the path. So, because, in other words, the punning verse is radical. A person who practices the way is like a bandit, you know, like a person who breaks everything down, breaks all the links, smashes everything apart, who goes beyond faith and gratitude and all the sort of normal virtues to total abandonment, who vomits out, right, all attachments, all, you know, pleasant things, and just is like completely naked and free. And that person is not a good person, but is an audacious person, is a daring person. It's a very daring, the path of the Buddha is very daring. And the other thing is just that this punning weird verse is kind of like, in a way, funny and a little crazy, you know, and bizarre. And, you know, you don't think of the authors of the Dhammapada or any of the early Buddhist texts, for that matter, as having much of a sense of humor. You know, it's very beautiful and nice, but it's not, you wouldn't call it like lighthearted and humorous. Nothing in the Dhammapada seems lighthearted and humorous, and yet you have this verse. So I always see a lot more humor in the teachings than a lot of people think is there. But I think there is humor in the text, and so far we have not come across another line that's anything like that line. So, all right, let's go on to chapters 8 and 9, and I'm just going to read these and make some light comments. The thousands, chapter 8 is called The Thousands. Better than a thousand meaningless statements is one meaningful word, and we just heard this recited. Better than a thousand meaningless statements is one meaningful word, which, having been heard, brings peace. And that's the important part. Having been heard brings peace. Better than a thousand meaningless verses is one meaningful line of verse, which, having been heard, brings peace. Better than reciting 100 meaningless verses is one line of Dharma, which, having been heard, brings peace. So those three stanzas strike me as, you know, really beautiful and important. And it reminds me of, you know, the power of words. Right? Words have the, you know, like Dogen says, they have the power to turn the destiny of a nation. And they have the power to turn a person's life. So language and words is really important, but the words have to be heard. And it just strikes me how many wasted words there are in the world, you know, how we prattle on about this and that, and how, you know, you read the news and it's sometimes I'm reading the news and I'm thinking to myself, why am I reading this, you know? I do want to know what happened somewhere. But then there's so much commentary now and so much opinion about everything that's not that consequential. So the amount of wasted words in our own minds and in the world is truly astonishing. So it makes you appreciate a word that is not wasted, that is real. But then you have to know how to hear that word. You have to really have the capacity to listen. And that means you have to really be there for those words. So to me, that's a profound thing. A word is profound, and listening to a word is profound. And then another thing that strikes me about these three verses, one after the other, is that it seems like, you know, you'd think that the Dhammapada would be all the time privileging the Dharma, the Dharma, the Dharma. But here, it seems like there's no hierarchy, or there's no difference between a meaningful word, and a meaningful word might not be a word of Dharma, a meaningful line of verse, and it doesn't stipulate that that line of verse is a line of Dharma, but it's a meaningful line of verse. And the third one is, a line of Dharma, which apparently is different from the first two. So I think it's the Dhammapada is here saying that what's important is meaningful words that come from the heart, from the soul, that can be heard, whether or not they're words of Dharma. They're important and they're beautiful. Greater in combat than a person who conquers 1,000 times 1,000 people is the person who conquers herself. And here, the word conquer, I would rather use tame or gentle oneself or tame oneself. Conquer is a little much. Certainly it is better to conquer oneself than others. For someone who is self-restrained and always lives with mastery, neither a god, a Gandhaba, nor Mara and Brahma together could turn conquest into defeat. So this is I think it's a radical thing, as we'll find out from the next stanzas. This was what was unusual about the Buddha's path for its own time, was that the Buddha was talking about taming oneself, you know, observing one's conduct, seeing what was positive, what was negative, seeing what brought happiness, what brought sorrow, and shaping conduct based on awareness and intention. And I think all of that was pretty new at the time, because before that, religion had other goals. So in a way, one of my thoughts is that Buddhism was a radically ethical path in the sense of leading a life of goodness and training the mind so that you could lead such a life. So that required overcoming one's natural negative passions. You know, when pushed, you push back. You know, when yelled at, you yell back. That's what we naturally do. And here Buddha says, no, we can do better than that. And that's what my path is all about, because when you shout back, when they shout at you, you put misery on top of misery, and the world is a place of suffering when you live like that. So, conquering oneself, to be self-restrained, to live carefully, always with purchase over your life, your mind, you cannot be defeated. Even the Mara and all the armies of Mara can't defeat you. Better than 1,000 ritual sacrifices offered every month for 100 years is one moment's homage offered to one who has cultivated herself. So this is the kind of religion that the Buddha, this is the religious context in which the Buddha was operating, and it was a typical religious context all over the world at that time. Rituals were performed because the ancient texts required them, and religious practice consisted of knowing how to perform those rituals and performing them in the right way, at the right time, with the right equipment, and so on. And that's what sacred and holy people did. And the Buddha proposed, instead of that, why don't you tame yourself? Why don't you make your conduct beautiful? Why don't you create happiness for yourself and those around you? And don't worry about the ritual sacrifices at all. So here, though, specifically, it's not only, it's better to notice someone who has conquered themselves or tamed themselves and pay homage to that person, presumably for the purpose of learning from them, than it is to do all the rituals in the right way. Better than 100 years in the forest tending a ritual fire is one moment's homage offered to one who has cultivated himself. This is repeating the same thought in slightly different words. Whatever sacrifice or offering a merit seeker might perform in an entire year is not worth 1/4 as much as expressing respect to those who are upright. So, you know, you got merit. You did the sacrifices properly, and you received virtue and merit and power from having done that. And then if you're a holy person, people could make offerings and pay homage to you, and you could transfer some of that virtue to other people. But here they're saying, no, don't bother with that. Express respect instead, not to the ones who make the sacrifices, but to the ones who are upright. And here, upright meaning basically are good, follow precepts, are people of integrity, straightforward people without guile. In Zen, straightforward mind is an expression that is used a lot. For the person who always shows respect and always reveres worthy people, four things increase: lifespan, beauty, happiness, and strength. So, promise of rewards. You're gonna, for Hanukkah or Christmas, you're gonna increase your lifespan. You're gonna be more beautiful. You're gonna be happier, and you're gonna be strong. And that might be not necessarily in this life, but it might be in future lives. So I think the Buddha is, you know, a lot of the Dhammapada is meant to be persuasive, right? It's to try to encourage you to practice the Buddha's way, because it's good for you. The Buddha knows that. And he's trying to encourage you in whatever way he can. So here he's saying, this is really going to be good for you in all these ways that you want. Better than 100 years lived with an unsettled mind, devoid of virtue, is one day lived virtuous and absorbed in meditation. Better than 100 years lived with an unsettled mind, devoid of insight, is one day lived with insight and absorbed in meditation. Better than 100 years lived lazily and lacking in effort is one day lived with vigor and exertion. So, of course, the whole conceit of the chapter is 1,000 of this is not as good as only one of this. So much superior is the path of the Buddha that 1,000 days of sacrificing is not as good as one day of venerating an upright person. And here, again, living 100 years with an unsettled mind is not as good as living one day in virtue, in insight, and with vigor. So these are the words that express the virtues being proposed here. Vigor, insight, to be settled, to be virtuous, to be tamed, to exercise restraint, and then the word meditation. And all these things seem to go together. And Sue, in her talk at the all-day sit, was talking about sitting with pain in Zazen, and her saying, you know, I don't get, like, why is this a virtue to sit in pain in Zazen? And she had a lot to say about that. I don't want to make it oversimplified. But there is, you know, I think that while none of us, I think, are into tough guy virtues, we have enough of that in the government. You know, we don't need that ourselves. On the other hand, I think these virtues of, you know, resolution, to be resolute, to have some vigor, to have some sense of discipline, to have some sense of restraint. These are virtues, I think, that are not so commonly touted, you know, in the modern times. But I think that that's for sure what the Dhammapada is advocating, and it's something to think about. Whoever uses the word virtue, and yet we want to be a virtuous person according to the Dhammapada. We want to be someone who is sane, who has insight, settled, who has insight, and has vigor. virya paramita, right? The joyful effort requires some vigor. Better than 100 years lived without seeing the arising and passing of things is one day lived seeing their arising and passing. So this one is a little different because this one is not about an insight, but it's about vision. And the vision is the vision of impermanence, really understanding impermanence. And when we were down in Mexico, since it's Rahatsu Sesshin, I always am talking about the Buddha and the Buddha's enlightenment and so on. And so I was talking about the first sermon, you know, that the Buddha ever gave, which I'm sure you've heard me talk about. It's very famous, Turning the Wheel of the Law Sutra. And at the end of the sutra, Buddha is preaching a sermon to the five ascetics, and one of them understands. Buddha is, you know, is thinking, nobody will ever understand my awakening, it's impossible. But Kondanya understands, and then Buddha's elated. He says, Kondanya understood, Kondanya understood. And that's the moment that I was saying in the Sesshin, that that's the most important moment in Zen. In Zen, the most important moment is not the Buddha's awakening. The most important moment is the Buddha realizing that he could communicate with other people, and other people could actually practice. And that's when the Zen lineage starts, really, the recognition that, no, this can be handed on. It's not just some great thing that happened to the Buddha. It can be handed on through our communication, through our relationships with one another. Anyway, it says, what did Kondanya understand? And what he understood was, things arise and pass away. That's what Kondanya understood. Something that everybody who's 5 years old understands, but not really, right? None of us really understand. What does it mean to arise and pass away? It's a very profound thing, impermanence and the arising and the passing away of everything. So here, that's what is prized. Better than living 100 years is living one day and knowing that. Better than 100 years lived without seeing the deathless is one day lived seeing the deathless. Better than 100 years lived, and the deathless is capitalized, the deathless is an epithet or a name for nirvana. Better than 100 years lived without seeing the ultimate Dharma is one day lived seeing the ultimate Dharma. So all of this is sort of more or less saying, well, you know, it's what's not important, the quantity of life that you have. What's important is the quality of those moments that you live. So it's better to live a true and virtuous life than to live a very, very, very long life without truth and virtue. It's just not worthwhile. And here, in Buddhism, you know, death doesn't mean death exactly. Death means confusion, fear, agitation, anxiety. Death in Buddhism is not an end. Death is an agitated ongoingness that won't stop. So you die in our scientific materialistic life, we think, well, that's the end. She was really nice, but now she's gone. But from a Buddhist point of view, no, death is not the end. If a person has an uncultivated mind, the moment of death is full of agitation and fear and terror, and it leads to more and more suffering in the various bardos and future lives. So death doesn't mean death. Buddha is deathless, which means that when the Buddha passes out of this life, it isn't fear and agitation and terror leading to more and more and more. It's peace. Nirvana is deathless, and it's peace. And then, of course, just to say, as we all know, that in our path, we sort of retranslate that, and we say, yes, but we're on the Bodhisattva path, so we're not going to have peace exactly. We're going to keep being born into this world, even though we know how troubling it is, because we want to be helpful to others. So, but instead of our being born out of our agitation and our confusion, we're going to be born out of our vow to be of service and benefit to others. So that's an energy, that's a life force. So it's disturbing, right? It means we have to keep on going. But we want to do that on purpose. We want to keep on going on purpose because we care. So we're going to have just that much agitation, not too much, basically peaceful and pretty good, but we're going to keep on going. The Dhammapada doesn't share that point of view. Dogen would say it's the same point of view. It's really that's what the Dhammapada really means, but the Dhammapada explicitly doesn't seem to be saying that. Okay, chapter 9. Evil. Which I don't know. I didn't. I only consulted a couple of translations. So, and both of them use the word evil. Probably it's something like unwholesomeness. It's the opposite of goodness. It's suffering and confusion and difficulty. But I'm not sure that the Western concept of evil, I'm pretty sure, is not the same in Buddhism. Anyway, let's just say evil. Be quick to do good. Restrain your mind from evil. When one is slow to make merit, one's mind delights in evil. So this is saying, you know, I think that what's behind this is the idea that we all have a natural desire to be good and do good. It's a happier thing, you know, to feel that way. But we also have, because of our conditioning, we've all been conditioned by societies and parents and environments. We also have the ability to do bad things and temporarily, at least, keep doing them. So it takes a little bit of effort here to emphasize the positive and de-emphasize the negative. So this is kind of a call to action. Do good. Restrain your mind from what might be at first tempting to do. And if you're not on it, you know, you might find yourself, before you know it, sliding down a path that you really don't want. Having done something evil, don't repeat it. Don't wish for it. Evil piled up brings suffering. So again, evil is a strong word, and you know, we might say there's nobody here who would ever do evil. But probably everybody here would have, you know, a momentary unkind thought or jealousy or envy or self-denigration or all kinds of thoughts that or actions even that we would consider to be not the best. So when you find yourself thinking or doing in that way, notice it and don't repeat it. And don't validate it. Because if you go down that path, you're going to be like making a big pile of trouble. And, you know, you're going to be the one to suffer. Others too, but you. So don't do that. Having done something meritorious, repeat it. Wish for it. Merit piles up, brings piled up brings happiness. So this is, like I say, a call to training the mind, if you will. And I think, like, in our practice, I have a little note in my margin. There's four things that we do. This is our train. This is the way we actually train. And this is sort of like what we do in everyday Zen commonly. We've always done this. First of all, we sit. There's nothing that is going to tend you toward the good more than a regular sitting practice. So we sit. And at first it looks like, oh, it's just sitting. But actually sitting is like, it introduces you to this whole world. Once they're sitting, there's going to be listening to the Dharma, right? Like we do every week at seminar. So it's not just sitting. It's also sitting and some teaching. But that's not enough just to sit and hear teachings. You have to actually apply the teachings and investigate them for yourself so that you know them for yourself. Not just repeating things you read in a book or things you heard, but making it real. Dogen uses the word realization. So we make the teachings real by our own actions. And then the fourth step is have friends and reminders. So you're doing this with other people and they're helping you to remember, and you have a schedule or some kind of round of practice that helps you to remember to do this. Because otherwise, it's a very confusing world, and all kinds of things draw you away, but nothing's more important than this. So we are actually in a kind of ongoing training, in a sense. I mean, we don't call it training because it's not like we're whipping ourselves into shape and looking for a specific result, but we're in a process, right? Even an evil doer may see benefit as long as the evil has yet to mature. But when evil has matured, the evil doer will meet with misfortune. So you might think, well, you know, I told a few lies and I was a little nasty over here, over there, but you know, no big deal. Nothing bad happened to me, you know, I did that, I said that, nothing bad happened. But this is saying, well, you not yet. Nothing bad happened yet, but it will. Take my word for it, the Buddha says, it will. A doer of good may meet evil fortune as long as the good has yet to mature, but when the good has matured, the doer of good will meet with good fortune. So this is like one of the big problems in theistic religions, you know. It's like one of the big controversies is like, if God is good, and everybody knows that God is like a good God, God is not like a horrible God. Everybody, believers, right, are thinking God is good. If God is good, how come this world is such a wreck? You know, that's a problem. I knew a person, you say, who went to church every single Sunday, was the most virtuous person in the world, good to their family, gave it to charity, everything good, and that person got cancer at the age of 45 and died. And I know another person who's the biggest scoundrel in the world, talked trash all the time, cheated people, did horrible things, trashed their family, everything bad. They lived to be 79 years old, and they're still going strong, and they're super successful and rich. What kind of a God is that? You know, why should I be doing good when that kind of thing happens? This is a problem for me. Well, this is the answer in Buddhism to that problem. You just haven't waited long enough. Wait long enough, and 100% of the time, evil will bring evil, and good will bring good. Okay, it didn't happen in this lifetime. Wait till that son of a bitch is born into the next lifetime. You'll see what happens to them. So that's what they actually, that's the way they actually look at it. And so, but the thing about this that's important, whether or not you believe in rebirth and so on or not, the thing that's really important here is, and I think you can all verify this for yourself, you can figure out, just by your own experience, how when your mind is tending toward evil, quote-unquote, you know, negativity, difficulty, difficult things will happen to you. You will have a lot of unhappiness and trouble. And the converse is also true. You practice long enough, and somehow you know, certainly for sure, 100%, and this is what the Buddha taught, that good brings good results, evil brings evil results, and that's 100% of the time. It's unerring. So even if it doesn't look like that in the short term, you know it to be true. And so then you have like the incentive to like not do bad stuff and to do good stuff, because you know how that's just the way it is, and you know that. And you're just not tempted anymore. At some point, you know that so much that there's no temptation to do bad stuff, because, you know, like, why would you want to do that? You know exactly. And I always used to use the analogy of putting your hand in a candle flame. it's not a, you don't need to use a lot of logical arguments to convince a person. Don't put your hand in the candle flame and leave it there. This is not a good thing to do. You don't want to do that. You don't have to convince anybody. All they have to do is put their hand in the candle flame, and immediately they'll never do it again because it burns. And evil karma is exactly like that. Don't do that stuff. It hurts. So you're no longer, when you realize that and you feel the hurt, you no longer want to do that stuff anymore. So your mind is not wanting to speak, act, and think in those ways anymore because you realize how painful it is and how happy it is, the opposite. Don't disregard evil, thinking, it won't come back to me. With dripping drops of water, even a water jug is filled little by little. A fool is filled with evil. Don't disregard merit, thinking, it won't come back to me. With dripping drops of water, even a water jug is filled, little by little, a sage is filled with merit. So this is, you know, little by little, I think that we want to become, I mean, it's very old-fashioned, right? But we want to become people of integrity. We would like to be a person who, not, I mean, there's such a thing as pretending to do good because they told you you're supposed to, you know? But here, it's like, no, this is really very, just very real. This is how you feel about things. This is how life looks to you. This is how you are. You actually are that way. A person of integrity who really and genuinely wants to love and support other people, not hurt them in any way. And in a very normal, everyday way, not some big, you know, deal, but just be a person of integrity. Little by little, drop by drop, you are training yourself. I think we're all doing this. We're all training ourselves to be people of integrity. And the point of that is that you then are a resource for other people. If you're, you know, who doesn't seek out a person of integrity for support and help and advice or whatever when they need it? So we're all becoming those people for all the people in our lives, for our families and our communities. And that's what the path of the Buddha is all about. As a merchant carrying great wealth in a small caravan avoids a dangerous road, and as someone who loves life avoids poison, or as someone who doesn't want to stick their hand in a candle flame, so should you avoid evil deeds. And this one is really interesting to me. I learned something new from these verses that I never knew before. A hand that has no wounds can carry poison. Poison does not enter without a wound. There are no evil consequences for one who does no evil. So that's interesting, right? If you have a wound, right, and it's open, and there's you come in contact with poison, the poison poisons you. So that's the analogy, is if you're a person who doesn't have integrity, if you're not whole, you're leaking, you have little holes that the worldly troubles can sneak inside of you and get you. But if you live a life of integrity, you can be in the middle of the world, which is so crazy and mixed up. You don't have to run away from that world because the craziness and the mixed upness of it doesn't really get under your skin because your skin is whole and doesn't have any perforations in it. So the worldly confusion can't get in. And what I learned from this is, if this is not too much in the weeds, there's a word in Buddhism called asrava, which is related to these words here. And asrava means outflow. So a Buddha or an arhat or a very established practitioner has, they say, dried up the outflows. Or they call it leaking. They don't have any leaks, you know. And so asrava is leaking, a leak or an outflow. But what I didn't realize is that the derivation of the word comes from the idea of a wound. And when you have a wound that's infected, right, and it's not healing, the wound leaks, right, doesn't it? It has pus, it has all kinds of separating ick that comes out of a wound that's open and not healing. So that's what it is. That's what the world is full of, people with open wounds, and the wounds are leaking, and those leaking wounds are causing all kinds of bad behavior and all kinds of confusion and violence in the world. The Dharma is a path of healing. So it's not as if people in the Dharma don't have wounds. We all have wounds, but we heal our wounds through the path. And our wounds having been healed, they no longer leak, right? So we're no longer able or tempted to do the things that cause harm and trouble to others. And so in a certain way, I mean, what it's saying is it's like we're immune in the world. We can be in the world with all of its trouble and all the nasty people who might yell at us and jump up and down and hit us over the head with stuff. And it'll hurt our head, but we'll be okay because our wounds are healed. And we're not leaking from those wounds anymore. Like fine dust thrown against the wind, evil comes back to the fool who harms a person who is innocent, pure, and unblemished. So, of course, you can be harmed by someone else, but you don't need to punish them for that. Punishment and vengeance is not part of the Buddhist path. I mean, it seems to be something that is valued in other traditions, it's seemingly. But in the Buddhist path, vengeance is not a part of it, because one need not venge or punish someone who hurts a virtuous person, because that person will receive the karmic results of those actions. Just like throwing dust at you and the wind blows the dust back at you. That's what happens when you try to hurt someone who is innocent, pure, and unblemished. Some are reborn in a womb. Evildoers are reborn in hell. People of good conduct go to heaven. Those without toxins are fully released in nirvana. And those without toxins is those without outflows, those without leaking are fully released in nirvana. And as you know, there are hells and heavens in Buddhism, just like there are in Christianity, although the Christians seem to be more serious about their heavens and hells than the Buddhists do, because the Christian hells are eternal. So if you're a sinner and you go to hell, there's no respite. Buddhist heavens and hells, both, are only temporary. So they're not quite as big a deal. You might only be in hell for, I don't know, a few million years, and then after that you've paid your price, and then you'll be reborn in a more advantageous realm. Because everybody is on the path toward Buddhahood. However circuitous or difficult the path may be, that's where everybody's going. So if you have to spend a few thousand lifetimes in hell, well, that's too bad. So that's certainly an incentive to do good in this life. But it's not the end of things, the way it is in the Christian hells. You will not find a spot in the world, not in the sky, not in the ocean, not inside a mountain cave, where you will be free from your evil karma. You can't escape your deeds, ever. You know, if you do bad stuff, and then you reform, and then you do a lot of good stuff, you sort of mitigate the problem, but something that has been done can never be undone. That's a scary thought, but isn't it true? That which has been done can never be undone, so there's always some way in which you are always responsible for those deeds, even after you've repented and straightened yourself out. Nowhere you can go to escape. You will not find a spot in the world, not in the sky, not in the ocean, not inside a mountain cave, where death will not overtake you. And in this case, death, as I said, means anxiety, confusion, loss, shame, disaster, which is what you'll experience at the time of death, and then go on to worse environments. So that's my little commentary, sort of impressionistic, quick commentary to chapters 8 and 9, and we'll go on from there. Before we do groups, I'd like to just say a few things, just in case some people have to leave, about upcoming schedules. So today's the 17th. Next Wednesday is Christmas Eve, so we won't meet next Wednesday or the following Wednesday. So we'll take 2 weeks off for the holiday, and on January 7th we'll meet again for chapter 10. We'll go on. Also, this Saturday, is that right? Saturday, we're having a gathering at the church, so all of you guys in the Bay Area can come to the church, and I hope you will. We've been doing this the last several years as sort of end of the year time to be together. We will sit for half a day quietly, Zazen, Kinhin, Zazen, you know, and then in the afternoon, and we'll all bring a bag lunch, and we'll have a lunch together, and then in the afternoon we'll have some sort of organized conversation. How's everybody doing? How's the Sangha doing? And we'll also, I think there's a link on the website, should be, for those of you online who want to attend online. You can also attend online. And we put that, when we're having the discussion, we'll put the computer up so you can hear the discussions and participate in them.
And if you have been registered and you plan to come in person, please do. Thank you.
There's our Eno speaking. Yeah, we have it. And the registration is up on the website. You can. The link is there. And also, I thought I would talk about the homework assignment. By the way, it was really quite wonderful that so many people took up Sue's suggestion to memorize a verse and gave us your verse. That was nice. Maybe we'll do just as well next time. And this time you have like 3 weeks to work on this. And this is not too an easy one. This is going to be a big deal one. And here's the homework assignment. Good and evil, right? And I think we know the whole complex of what we call evil thoughts and impulses and actions and deeds and words. And the other side, those that are good, compassionate, settled, kind, so on. So the assignment is to observe as much as you can all of this in your daily life. Observe the flow of thoughts and feelings and actions that seem to be on the good side and those that seem to be on the evil side, assuming that we're all going to have some of each. And just observe how it is for you when it's one or the other, what your experience is. See if it's true that there is a sense of confinement and limitation over that which is not good, and a sense of opening or joy or happiness when the mind is inclined toward peacefulness, toward goodness. Anyway, to the best of your ability, study that. And a little hint is, when you're sitting in the morning, make it a habit to remind yourself sometime during the sit, at the beginning or at the end, that you're going to do that during the day. Prompt yourself. Because the hardest thing about stuff like this is that you forget to do it, right? The day goes by and you say, oh, geez, I totally forgot about it. So if you remind yourself every morning that you're trying to do it, you'll have a better chance of doing it. And so this is like be several weeks. So we'll see what happens. If anybody was able to sustain this to some extent, and what your experience was, what you learned from it. So that's the homework assignment. That's kind of a big thing, you know. If you actually can do that and get good at it, it might have a big impact on, you know, the way you live your life on an everyday basis. Okay. Now we're going to do groups.
Recording stopped.
So for our groups, this is a little bit harder to do or weird, but let's try it. I have four words for you that came up in the chapters that we read. And I'd like you to remember these four words and react to them in the groups. And that is to say, how do these words strike you? Are they words you think about or apply to yourself? Are they foreign? Are they weird? Do you practice them? Just take one of them if you want to take one, or take more than one, or all four if you want. Here are the words. Virtue, insight, vigor, and restraint. So the question is, are these words that characterize your life in some way? Are they words that you would like to bring into your life as something you'd want to add to who you are, what you do? Virtue, insight, vigor, restraint. So, to the best of your ability, you know, reflect on those. If, as we always say, you have something else on your mind that's really important, something that came up in the talk or in your life that you would rather talk about because that's what's real for you and this is not so real for you, go ahead and do that. That's okay. We want these conversations to be real, not some phony thing you're supposed to do. So take it wherever you need to take it. And if there are any new people in the group, just to say that we've been doing these conversations for a long time. We're very open to one another. We don't ask questions or question one another. We just simply listen. You have 3 minutes. It's self-timed, so somebody in the group's going to time. Everybody has their phone, you know, and their little devices that can time 3 minutes. 3 minutes, 3 minutes, 3 minutes for each person to speak. And everybody listens with generosity, and there's no critique of anybody here. We want to give everybody a chance to speak honestly and from the heart, and we're going to listen. So with that, somebody is going to put you into groups.